Hello and welcome to the Drug Science Podcast with me, David Nutt. Here we're bringing together experts and activists for a rational, honest and informed conversation about drugs.
A Fascinate Productions podcast for drug science.
So welcome everyone to the Drug Science Podcast. I'm joined by the host of Say Why to Drugs, the podcast in the University of Liverpool, by the lecturer Susie Gage. Welcome to London.
Thank you very much.
Singer, songwriter and medical cannabis advocate, fresh off her total world tour, Joss Stone. Thanks for joining us, Joss.
Thank you for having me.
And to complete the panel, a woman who's been on the front line of the fight for medical cannabis in order to treat her son, Alfie. It's a pleasure to be joined by Hannah Deacon.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Today, we're discussing the topic of medical cannabis. But first, here are a few clips to put this into context.
I have multiple sclerosis. I have a lot of pain, I have a lot of spasms. I have bladder weakness, I have trouble walking distances, appetite, problems sleeping, and cannabis helps with all of those different things.
Clark French is the founder of the United Patients Alliance, a medical cannabis support group here in the UK.
The problem with the drugs that are available in NHS, for pain especially, they're mainly opiate-based.
There were over 23 million opioid prescriptions during 2018, a number which has been rapidly rising for more than a decade. Clark thinks there's another way.
GW Pharmaceuticals are making Sativex. Even though my doctor, my MS nurse and my neurologist all think that I should have Sativex, the NHS can't pay for it, so I have to break the law every single day just to be well.
MS sufferers aren't the only ones who can benefit from cannabis-based medication.
My neighbour complained frequently about being able to hear me screaming through the walls.
Carly Barton suffered a stroke in 2010, which led her to develop the neurological condition, fibromyalgia. After 6 years of taking ever-increasing amounts of the opioids morphine and fentanyl, she decided to take a different approach.
When I was taking fentanyl, morphine and diazepam, I would still be in a sort of 8 out of 10 pain. Cannabis has got the ability to bring down my pain from a 10 to like a 2 in the space of 5 to 10 minutes.
But despite being given one of the first prescriptions for medical cannabis in the UK, Carly has found getting the medicine she needs far more difficult than you might think.
I have tried to get this through in a legal way. I had a legal NHS prescription. I'm about to run out. I'm going to have to call a dealer to the house. I don't want to be a criminal. I literally just want to have my medicine so that I can live my life.
Carly isn't the only one to be put in this situation. Back to Clark.
My mum, she also has MS. She isn't a cannabis consumer because she's not comfortable with breaking the law. I will put my health above it and I will say, you know what, I'm going to do it. I'm going to break the law because I want that quality of life.
We need clear guidelines which say cannabis is medicine and people that consume it should not be criminalised for that.
So let's start with Hannah, because you have been pioneering access of medical cannabis to the UK. For how long is that?
We started our Alfie's Hope campaign in January 2017, and Alfie received the first permanent cannabis licence. Well, his doctors received the licence to prescribe for Alfie on the 19th of June 2018. A day that I will never forget.
So tell us about Alfie's story.
Alfie has a very rare epilepsy called PCDH19. There's only 9 boys in the world with it. It's a non-inherited genetic condition as well, so Dad and I don't have it. So it just happened. The first seizure he had was when he was 8 months old. I found him in his bed having a huge tonic-clonic seizure. He was boiling hot. I waited for it to stop. I put him in the car and I drove him to my local hospital, and we were absolutely terrified. I've never seen a seizure before in my life. It's never been in my family. We got to our local hospital and we were told, oh, it's probably just a febrile convulsion, which can happen when you have a high temperature. But it was quickly very obvious that Alfie was very seriously ill and he had lots and lots of seizures. In the end, we were transferred to Stoke Hospital, where we were there for 2 weeks and they couldn't help us. And I insisted that we went to a specialist unit, where we ended up at Great Ormond Street Hospital. And after 3.5 weeks of him being on an life support machine. He was treated with intravenous steroids and his seizures stopped, and he was diagnosed at that point with immune responsive epilepsy. So he is only responsive to steroids. Nothing else works. We've tried the ketogenic diet. We've tried immunoglobulins. We've tried nearly 15 antiepileptics, and all antiepileptics do for him is make him either extremely aggressive or cause him to have seizures. So he has a very, very difficult condition. And as he got older, his seizures just got worse. And by age 5, he was having a severe chronic cluster of seizures every week. So we were in hospital, actually, to put it into context, 48 times before we went to Holland in 1 year, which is pretty much every week. So we were going into hospital 2 o'clock in the morning in an ambulance, emergency, trying to get steroids into him. It was very traumatic for me and my partner and my family. You know, it was awful. And the doctors were saying, if the seizures don't kill him, the steroids will.
So then when did you think of cannabis?
Well, at that point, he was having up to 25 doses of intravenous methylprednisolone a month, which no one can tolerate. And I just felt absolutely desperate. And I was watching my child die in front of my eyes, basically. And I just thought, right, OK, well, I can either accept this and I can listen to the doctors completely and accept that they're gods and that they get everything right, or I can start questioning it. And that's what I did. I just sort of thought, well, you know, what do steroids do? They suppress your immune response. So, OK, this is an immune response, maybe. This is what Great Ormond Street said. So let's go online and look at epilepsy treatments. And I just found medical cannabis kept coming up as a very good treatment for epilepsy. I talked to families in America and Canada and decided to do some research. I remember watching a very good film with you on YouTube about the endocannabinoid system. So I learned that, and I just thought, I need to learn. I need to understand what I'm talking about. I learned the difference between hemp and, you know, cannabis sativa and indica and what it does and all that sort of stuff. And I went to my doctor in March 2017 and said, what about cannabis? And he actually said to me at that point, if you talk to me again about cannabis, I'm going to speak to social services about you.
What, to take your child away?
Yeah. So
absolutely absurd.
I moved my doctor because I thought, well, you know, he's going to die. And Drew and I have always said, you know, if we do ever lose our child, we need to know that we have done everything in our power to keep him alive, because then I might not have to live with so much guilt, you know. And that's what's always driven me, is to know that I've done the right thing for my child. So we moved to hospital. We met a wonderful doctor who had us in for a month and tried to do everything he could to stop using steroids, and we couldn't. And I said to him, what about medical cannabis? We've spoken to our GP, our paediatrician. We even had the support of our MP at that point. And he said, his words were to me, you have no choice, go for it. And I thought, well, thank God we found one doctor that actually doing the right thing by my child.
And going for it was going to Holland.
Yeah. So in September 2017, we went to The Hague and we lived there for 5 months. And my mission was to collect as much data as possible to show that my son responded to cannabis. And the first 5 weeks, he didn't respond at all. And I remember thinking, oh my God, we're going to have to go home and watch him die. And then as I was thinking that, he went 17 days and without a seizure. And then every month that went by, he got better and better and better. And we added in a very small amount of extra THC and he went 41 days. And when he did have seizures, he had 2 or 3. So then in February 2018, we decided to come home and fight our battle in the UK. And that's when we met Peter Carroll from End Our Pain, who said that he would help us with strategy. I mean, I've never done a campaign in my life. I've never been on TV. I've never done anything like this. So he got me on TV and got the right MPs behind us and everything. And in beginning of March 2018, the government put out after an interview I'd done on BBC Breakfast, saying that there was no medicinal value to cannabis and that they would not allow Alfie to be prescribed Bedrolite or Bedica. And I also met a very eminent paediatrician, neurologist, who said to me, you will never get a THC prescription on the NHS. So for me, I thought, right, OK, come on, bring it on.
Absolutely.
I thought, I'll prove you wrong. So in March 2018, I met the Prime Minister with my petition, and she allowed our doctors to apply for a licence, which has never happened in the UK before. It's only ever been pharmaceutical companies.
Was Alfie still in
Holland? No, we were in England then. So we took Alfie off the THC, which made him very, very poorly. So We did 3.5 months. Professor Mike Barnes led our group, amazing man who helped get our license, did a lot of work completely for free, months and months of work with the Home Office. And then on the 18th of June, after we'd agreed with the Home Office that we'd met everything that we needed to do, I had the Chief of Staff phone me on the 18th of June and say, oh, there's just one more thing, and I just lost my rag. And that's what I'm like. I'm very calm and very patient until at some point someone pushed it. And I just thought, I've had 3 months of watching my son suffer. I'm done. And that was the next day, the 19th of June, I went on the Today programme with John Humphreys, and I said, Theresa May looked me in the eye and she promised me she would help me, and I feel like I've been played, and I'm a mother of a very sick child, and you don't play the parents of sick children. And within 3 hours we had the license. So I had to play a little bit dirty in the end, but you know, I felt that I'd done everything.
Do you think it's incompetence at government or resistance or
it's a bit of both?
It's fear of the media?
I think it's fear of cannabis. Now, I had a lot of conversations with Nick Hurd, the Minister for Fire and Policing, who was dealing with it. I remember him saying to me, you know, we find this really difficult because it's out of our comfort zone. And that's the thing. I think they were just completely out of their comfort zone. These are people that have been told from the beginning of time, probably, that cannabis is dangerous and bad and it causes psychosis. And you're asking people to provide a prescription of that for a little boy who's got epilepsy. And I think, again, still the huge problem we see in the government now is stigma and fear.
Yes, it's difficult. I mean, you're lying about something for 50 years. To completely
people
change
tack. People start believing it, don't they?
Well, they do. They want to believe it because they end up being a prejudice. Mm. Well, Hannah, I've listened to you a number of times, and what you'll be pleased to know that after talking to you last week, I've started to write a paper on why the medical profession is just so backward on cannabis.
Mm.
Wow, well, that's a tough story. I mean, you've had a bit of trouble, Joss, over the years with being a proponent and a supporter of a rational view of cannabis. You want to share that with us?
Yeah, well, you know, when you support things like this, people just say, don't be so silly, you little hippie. That's usually what you get. It's difficult because people don't really want to hear it.
Mm.
And no matter how much you put in front of them, no matter how many testimonies like yours, they just don't want to hear it. And then when you go and speak to doctors and vets, for me, it was my dog that I dealt with.
Tell us about that then.
So, so Dusty. First, there was Missy. Missy was my Rottweiler, and I was using the oil with her. She didn't have cancer, she was just very poorly. And I'd been kind of interested in this for years previously, but I didn't know enough. So I was giving it to her because she wasn't eating. And then she did start eating. And then I went to my vet and I said, oh, I'm giving her this oil that I made in my kitchen. And of course, I don't know whether it's got this much THC and this much CBD. I have no idea. I just get the plant and I just make the oil and I give it to her. And she was getting better and better. And I said to my vet, this is what I'm doing. And he was like, you can't do that. Don't do that. I don't know what's going to happen with the other drugs we're giving her. So it made me nervous and I stopped, and then she died. It just went worse the second that I stopped. So when Dusty, my tiny little teacup poodle, she got sick, and I took her to the vets, and they said that she had a tumor in her bladder. She was kind of stopping to pee every 2 seconds. And I thought, this isn't right. She's so tiny. You know, it's going wrong. And they said, yeah, that there's a tumor there, but we can do chemotherapy and radiotherapy for this tiny little dog. I mean, she's half the size of a cat. She's 14. No, that will definitely kill her. They're like, well, that's what you have to do. And I said, no, I think I'll just give her some cannabis oil and see how it goes, because she's old and it could go well or not. 2 months later, just 2 months, I took her back. They scanned her, different vets, because I kind of fell out with the first ones. they scanned her and I said, please, can you tell me how big it is? Just measure it for me. And it was gone. Completely disappeared. So I don't know.
You need to go back to the previous vets and show them.
I need to show them. I know. But the frustrating thing is that you're having these arguments with people that, okay, look, they're not allowed to say, go ahead and try cannabis because it's not on their list of things that they're allowed to advise to you. I get that. But they should at least know something about it.
Quite.
Just Google it.
Mm.
You have a responsibility to Google it, like I did.
Mm.
But they don't. They don't even do that. They don't even want to entertain the conversation. And that I find really difficult.
Yes, that's something drugs, we found that really problematic. It's as if people want to deny the fact there is evidence from other countries. And actually, it was very pleasing last week that the health minister said, we should take into account evidence from other countries of medical cannabis. Of course we should. I mean, you wouldn't ignore evidence on other, you know, from other countries on any other drug. Why would you assume it was different in Britain? So at least maybe the debate's beginning to get a bit more open.
Why do you think, earlier you said you were looking into why they're so anti?
Yes.
Do you have an opinion on why?
I think it's complex. I think it's a...
Is
it's
it a, money?
No, no, actually, no. I think part of the problem is that the initiative is driven by people like you.
Yes.
You're not professionals.
Silly hippies.
How could you know better? Or, you know,
I remember my MP saying to me, when we first started advocating for cannabis, he said, but the problem is you're not a doctor.
Right.
And I said, no, but I'm a parent and I spend 24/7 with my child. But he said, but you're not a doctor. So that's no one wants to listen to what I've got to say because I'm not
field,
a doctor.
You're more educated than the doctor.
Yeah.
Because the doctor hasn't.
No, he
hasn't looked because it's not on his list of jobs to do that.
I mean, I am a doctor.
Okay, go on, Doc.
Patient comes to me and says, I found a cure for something I've been trying to treat them with for years.
Right.
I'd celebrate.
Brilliant.
I wouldn't say you're wrong. I mean, how could the patient be wrong? I mean, that's absurd, isn't it?
Right.
There's no knowledge. There's no teaching. I mean, when cannabis was banned, we didn't really know what it did. It was kind of, you know, magical, you know. But now we know that there are receptors in the brain and we know they're endocrine. You know, there's a huge science, but the medical profession doesn't teach that science. And one of the points I'm making in this paper I'm putting together is that doctors and vets have a responsibility to keep up to date with modern knowledge.
Right.
You can't just say, I don't know anything about it, so I won't use it.
So go find out.
That's unprofessional.
And do you know what? I'll give you the evening. Go home. Find out and call me tomorrow and let me know what you found out. But they can't. I don't know if their insurance allows that.
Well, it's complicated. But one thing drug science is doing is we are creating teaching packages. We've just put together a beautiful set of slides for medical students and pharmacy students, which we're going to roll out the beginning of next term so that every student that wants to learn will have access to something that's easy, digestible and right.
Mm.
So hopefully we'll move the field forward.
Hopefully. You'll probably know the answer to this. What is the punishment for taking cannabis illegally here in this country for medicinal use? Does anybody here know? Do you get years? Do you get fined? What do you get?
The reality is it's a Class B drug. So
you could go inside for a few years.
5 years, up to 5 years for possession. Yeah. Very few people
But I think the thing is as well, it's about whether you prove that it's medical use or not. The problem is that if you were found with plants in your home, that would be seen as recreational use, even though probably it's medical use.
And there is no threshold between personal and use and dealing. If it's dealing, you know, you could be 14 years in prison.
Oh my gosh. And then you have to look at, well, is it worth it?
Well,
a lot of the time it is.
Yeah, well,
what do you want to do?
You've decided, yeah. know, and it was worth it for your dogs, and you took a risk. And,
it was worth it, and it will always be worth it. Yeah, I know. Even though I tell everyone every day, I don't know why. I don't know. I don't
tell them where you live.
It's kind of a funny little conundrum. A friend of mine, his father was dying of cancer, and he was very, very much behind giving his dad this cannabis oil. And we don't know whether it's high in THC or not. We're just trying to help. We're just getting what we can and doing our best. And he's educating himself as I have, which is literally by watching things online as much as possible and listening to people like yourself. So he had spoken to his dad and his dad was like, oh, I don't know, because it's illegal. And that's really terrifying. And his family found it really hard to support that because it's illegal. And I remember speaking to his wife, this is a few days before he died really, and he was really, really suffering, like he couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep. It was the worst. And she was so upset, but she couldn't support it. She just couldn't. She had tears in her eyes and she just looked at me, she goes, but Joss, it's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my God, how? Yeah. How can this mean so much that you don't do that? They give it to him anyway, you know, and then he slept and ate. But, you know,
but I've sad. Experienced this. Sad. There are many patient organizations that support patients with different disorders.
Mm.
And some of them refuse to countenance the use of medical cannabis because it's illegal. They won't even do research on it because it's illegal. I mean, it's not illegal to research it, but they just say, if it's illegal, we don't want to touch
it.
We're a charity. We're not going to go somewhere that's illegal.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't illegal and it isn't illegal in other countries, but they have this sort of obsession with not breaking the law. They put that above everything else, which is ridiculous with a law
everything.
That's so irrational.
I think well, the older generation have this thing about doctors always being right.
Yeah.
The parents I work with, they all have access to information. They know what drug side effects are. They know what's in the drugs. They know all about cannabis, you know, because they've taught themselves. And actually, I think that's what's making this change happen, where people are starting to take responsibility for their own health and for their children's
health.
That's
what the health service wants. It actually wants patients to take responsibility, except for cannabis.
Yeah.
But we must move on, because Susie's been sitting here very quietly, worried we're not going to get to her. So you're a scientist, Susie, yes?
I am, yes. So I have done quite a lot of research into the links between recreational drug use and mental health in particular. All the research I've done has been on recreational cannabis use, which is obviously different. And what we have to do is we have to watch what people choose to do, and the people who choose to use cannabis recreationally are quite a different population from the people who will choose to use cannabis medicinally. So all of the findings that we've got from recreational cannabis, how likely those risk factors, that cannabis seems to increase the risk of, certainly cannabis in adolescence seems to increase the risk of cognition problems or learning and memory problems, likely to not go as far in education, all of these kind of things, how much that's to do with biological effects of cannabis and how much that's to do with the people who choose to use cannabis at a particular young age is really, really, well, it's impossible to tease out from using these observational studies where you just follow up groups of people over a period of time, see what they choose to do and see the differences that happen between these groups. Even if you know what all the differences are, taking account of them in a model is really difficult because you've got to measure them really accurately, and we probably can't do that, even if we know what they all are. So it's really important to not minimise the potential risks that cannabis might have for some people. But the important thing is, who are those people and what is it about the cannabis? Is it something to do with the levels of THC, for example? That seems to be something that's kind of...
Yeah, will you tell us a bit more about what's happened about THC in the last 20 years? Because people don't quite understand how things have changed.
Yeah, so, I mean, until quite recently, cannabis and THC in the research community were kind of used interchangeably in a way. Almost all of the research, experimental research, was looking at THC because THC is the component in cannabis that gives the kind of high of cannabis. So there was research that showed that if you gave someone THC, they would experience transient psychotic-like experiences, basically cannabis intoxication, but this would stop after a person was intoxicated. And it's only more recently that CBD has become more kind of widely researched as well. But actually there are hundreds, as you were saying earlier, there are hundreds of different cannabinoids, and that's before we then look at the other things in cannabis as well. And actually it's a very complicated plant. So with THC, from collecting samples, police seizures and that kind of thing, it looks like the levels of THC in cannabis have really gone up a lot in the last kind of 20 or 30 years. And potentially, if the THC is the thing in cannabis that's the kind of that increases the risk of lots of these potential negative outcomes for some groups of people, this is really important. But also alongside that, it looks like levels of CBD have really gone down in lots of the cannabis that's kind of available on the street or that's being used recreationally.
Breeding it out.
Potentially, or because of just the method that it's being grown in, it's not necessarily clear kind of why it's happening.
Well, people want to get high, that's why.
Well, I mean, that is one reason. Yeah.
Well, but it's not just that. It's not just that.
Right?
Don't they
make it stronger in THC? And
that's true. But I think actually the rise in concentration is also just this more bang for your buck. People want to get high.
Right.
So a stronger version, for less
right.
product. So it's because the criminalisation of the black market means in cannabis, in opiates, wherever you look, if you really try to prohibit something, people move to much stronger versions.
It was true with alcohol as well.
Exactly.
Although, interestingly, in the US, high-potency cannabis products are still really popular in states where cannabis is legal as well. So it's a complicated picture, but I think that's certainly a part of it, that prohibition drives up the strength.
Is it non-toxic? Tell us about that.
There are no reports of someone dying of overdose of cannabis.
Yeah, that's the one thing that distinguishes cannabis from pretty much any other drug is it's almost impossible to overdose, which means even if you accidentally eat too many brownies.
Which is lovely to know that.
And that's reassuring, isn't it? That's right. Whereas, yeah. look at last week, 1,200 deaths in Scotland, largely from opiates. And you think, wow. And there's none from cannabis. And yet they're both in the same schedule. They're both, schedule one drugs. It's absurd, really, to treat cannabis as dangerous as...
What are the negatives?
The negatives of cannabis are that some people get paranoid. Actually, sometimes I see that as a bit of a positive, because you
makes them more careful people.
Well, they don't use.
Oh, right.
I mean, once people start getting paranoid, they usually stop using. I mean, what we don't know, if it was legal, would people get less paranoid? Because some of the paranoia is because you're going to get caught. So it's kind of, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that they are out to get you with cannabis. So there's a sort of paranoia. It can bring on, if you've got a vulnerability to schizophrenia, it can bring it on. Right. It won't cause schizophrenia, but it might make you become...
Trigger it.
Yes, it might trigger it and precipitate it. And then there's dependence. And that's actually the biggest issue, I think, at present. I mean, probably 8% of people who use cannabis regularly get dependent. It's a different kind of dependence to alcohol and opiates because you don't have such a clear withdrawal. But it does mean that you are sort of locked into a cycle of use and continued use, which can get in the way. And eventually people do realise they're dependent and seek help.
And I think that's another quite important point to make about the evidence that we've got around the harms of cannabis at the moment, is that almost all of the negative effects are really driven by the population of dependent users in any research.
That's right.
Certainly the links with psychosis or psychotic-like experiences, there are actually very few studies looking at psychosis or schizophrenia itself. It's more kind of lower level. But in all of those studies, you really only see the link in people who are using high-potency cannabis every day or the people who've been diagnosed with cannabis dependency. Those group of people are really driving it, and they might not be the same as people who are using it less frequently, who are using less strong cannabis.
Is it right to say that it's mentally addictive rather than physically addictive?
That's a bit of both.
It's a little bit of both, okay.
But it's the nature of the fact that cannabis, when you take cannabis, it sits in your body for a long time. So you don't see this urgent withdrawal that you see from alcohol or
like
for opiates.
Ciggies,
because it comes out, or nicotine particularly, because the levels fall very fast. Yeah. Cannabis leaches out of the body slowly over a period of weeks. So people don't get a lot of withdrawal. They get a bit of sleep disruption. Mm. But that doesn't mean they're not dependent. That's the point I'm making. So,
I mean, you can get addicted to running. You can get addicted
indeed.
To...
That's why I never did it.
Anything.
But you're mentioning nicotine. I mean, another problem in terms of people becoming sort of psychologically dependent on cannabis is if you're mixing it with the nicotine, smoking it with tobacco, then you've got the added kind of...
Yeah.
You've got this link with the pleasurable experiences of cannabis and then
you're addicted to the nicotine
hit that you get, and so you've sort of in your head those kind of things become linked.
The good news is that if you're going to smoke nicotine, smoking it with cannabis reduces the harms of the tobacco.
Is that right?
Yes, there was a very interesting...
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding you. No, it's because cannabis burns at a lower temperature than tobacco.
Really?
So you get less toxins from...
But you're still better smoking cannabis
without
any tobacco.
It's better not smoking anything at all.
Unless you just not smoke, though, right?
It's better not to smoke, and you can vape it. We've got just a few minutes. I want to get back to Hannah now. Because so you've obviously been campaigning for children with epilepsy, but you must have worked with many other groups who are interested in cannabis for other disorders. And what's your sort of take on that? And what's a community of people like out there who are trying to move medical cannabis forward?
Well, there's a huge amount of groups and people who are trying to influence government and make change. Pain is the most important thing when it comes to cannabis medicine, because there are thousands of people in this country suffering with pain and issues with opioids. But I always feel as well that it's a bit insincere to talk about something when I don't understand it. And what I do understand is being a parent of a severely epileptic child, and that's why I try to be the voice of those parents who don't have a voice in the public domain. But there's a lot of work going on, and I actually think that, End Our Pain have over 120 supportive MPs who are signed up to support them within Westminster.
I think part of the problem is government thinks we've done our job, because all these 80 kids that you're looking after are going to be, okay, they can get the cannabis. We don't need to worry because you're the ones that people care about.
Yeah,
but it's a much bigger problem.
Yeah.
And there are many, many, many groups in many different areas.
Absolutely. Where... And that's what I think the work is now, which is, it is difficult because obviously the political climate in the UK is filling up the media, and we're struggling to get the media to be interested. But what we have to understand is that these families that I work with, for example, are still suffering. They're still having to raise thousands of pounds a month. Yeah, yeah. They might have private prescriptions. Yeah, yeah. The government have to be aware that this is not sorted. You know, there is still a huge amount of work to do, and changing the law. I mean, the Home Secretary actually said when the law changed, I am doing this so patients can access medicines that they need to help them to be well, pretty much. That was what he said. That's not happened. And what we saw in the Health Select Committee report, it said, well, we didn't manage expectations. Well, no, you didn't manage expectations. You need to sort that out. You can't just say, oh, sorry, Gov, we actually didn't manage expectations, because the floodgates are open. People want access, and now they're suffering, and now they're having to raise thousands of pounds. So you're absolutely right. The government think that they've done the right thing, but what they've done is slightly open the door and put the fear into the God into most clinicians, because they won't prescribe. We're seeing some private prescriptions because they're not bound by these very, very restrictive guidelines in the NHS. But yeah, there's still a huge amount of work to do. And I feel extremely passionate about making access more available to anyone suffering, but especially very severely ill children with epilepsy. So yeah, there's still a lot of work to do.
Keep telling your story and keep telling
it. I will, yeah.
I did not know that you could use cannabis in this country for medicinal use like that.
No, the law was changed on the 1st of November last year.
Wow. So that's really
specialist
amazing. That's
doctors.
Of you.
Well, because of our campaign, yeah,
well
and
done,
others, hun. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, we've actually got the best legislation in Europe for medical cannabis.
In theory.
Laughingly.
How did that happen? That's
laughingly,
amazing.
But no one actually uses
in theory,
it.
Yeah. So any doctor can prescribe, but no doctors are allowed to prescribe.
For any symptom, yeah. As long as it's GMP, basically.
So they don't, most of the doctors, they just don't know. That they can
well,
prescribe
they
it.
No, they're just having the frighteners put on.
So one thing's interesting, Hannah. So you're telling us that the law was changed last November. And any doctor can now prescribe, or any specialist doctor,
can prescribe for any condition.
And how many prescriptions on the NHS?
Other than Alfie's and Sophia Gibson in Northern Ireland, who both had licences before the law change, none.
Zero.
Zero.
So hang on, how many months is that? That's almost 9 months.
Do you think it's because they don't know, the doctors, that they are not aware that they can do this?
I think it's one, the doctors have had no training, and that's why I've said the law was changed far too quickly, and what they should have done is rolled out some good training first before they did that. Okay. It's also because we have the BPNA and the RCP issuing guidance.
So these are professional bodies.
The BPNA is British Paediatric Neurology Association. So if you're a paediatric neurologist, you are a member. They are actually a charity. They're not a professional body. They're not a royal college.
Okay,
they are just
right.
A charity. Mm-hmm. Who train their doctors, paediatric neurologists all around the world, actually. But they are seen as a very eminent organisation, and the government in the because there was no NICE guidance, the government asked the BPNA to issue guidance on prescribing for children with epilepsy. And that guidance actually stated that the only drug that should be prescribed is Epidiolex, which is actually currently unlicensed, and that all full extract GMP prescriptions should not be made because there's no understanding of safety and THC does cause damage to the growing brain. Well, actually, there's one study about teenagers who smoked high-strength THC, which can cause an exacerbation of mental health disorders. There's a risk and balance to every drug, but when you've got a child with having hundreds of seizures a day, surely it's worth trying a little bit of THC to stop them. So
that's the first thing. The first thing was they said you can prescribe it. Then the professional body said, well, there's not much evidence because the trials hadn't been done in the traditional way of double-blind. Yeah. So they dismissed the evidence that her son is alive.
Yeah.
That's not a real science. I mean,
no.
But they don't realise. I mean, every doctor knows that every time you treat a patient or a dog with any medicine, you're doing an experiment.
Of course you are.
There's no medicine that you can predict will work in any
person.
So every time it's an experiment. And if it works, you're grateful.
I've even had it suggested to me by very senior paediatric neurologists in the UK that what I've seen is a placebo response.
And
mad mothers like me are so desperate for their children to be well that it's a placebo. But actually, do you know what? If it was a placebo, who cares?
Yeah.
That is beyond absurd. I really think that's unprofessional.
Right.
One of the things Drug Science has done, by the way, is we've just written a position paper, which we're hoping the Lancet will take, top medical journal, where we've got a medical ethicist arguing that actually it's less ethical to deny someone with proven value of medicine than it is to prescribe a medicine off license.
Absolutely.
Because the reality is, in Alfie's case, there is proof.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, what more, you know, that's better than anything you've got. So not to prescribe to someone in which medical cannabis has worked, we believe is actually unethical.
It is.
And doctors should be really challenged about that.
Yeah.
But the other thing I want to tell you, that what the government did, so then it set up a special route for prescribing. So it said, instead of saying cannabis was a medicine, it said it was a medicine, but it was a special.
It is very special.
Well, it's special, but not in a good sense. Special in the sense that it's very dangerous.
Yeah,
and
right, okay.
If you prescribe a special, you're prescribing outside of your, if you're in the NHS, outside your insurance. And most doctors don't want to do that.
And that makes them fearful.
Very fearful. And it also very complicated. A special pad, you've got to have a pink pad to prescribe cannabis. So it's, yes, you can have it, you know, but the reality is we're not going to tell you how. Mm. And so people haven't.
And people are very, I think doctors are very worried medical legally as well, because they have to take complete responsibility. But what they have to remember is every time they prescribe an off-label unregulated medicine, which they do to children all the time, they are taking personal responsibility for that. So it's no different when they say, oh, but I'm taking personal responsibility. It's no different when you're prescribing a benzo to a six-month-old baby. It's exactly the same. And I think, again, it's this fear, it's this stigma, this is cannabis, this is frightening. And that's why education is now so important.
It's because they're frightened that the Daily Mail will, if one thing goes wrong, the Daily Mail will jump on them because they're so hysterical about it.
There's a lot of hypocrisy here as well, because a lot of the medications like benzodiazepines, like ketamine, are also used recreationally and illicitly. And so it's exactly the same situation. Oh. It's just a drug that's kind of hasn't moved that far down these steps
yet. It's safer, less harmful.
Well, quite, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually true. It tells you that the anti-cannabis propaganda, which has been running since about 1930, has been very, very effective.
Yeah, they've done very well.
But in other countries, things have got better. Now, this is the question from our Twitter followers. It's to you, Joss.
Oh.
And I guess you spent some time in the US, yes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what do you notice about the difference in public opinion about cannabis between the US and the UK?
Oh, they love it over there.
Yeah.
It's very normal over there. Very normal. Well, the situation that happened with my dog Dusty this morning, poodle, it was in the US. So I had one experience with a vet that was very much like the one I had in the UK, which was, I cannot discuss this with you and you now need to leave. And then another experience with a vet in the city, in Brooklyn, in a place that's, I guess, more lefty and a little bit more open. And she was like, I'm not supposed to discuss this with you, but I think you should go and do it. You know, so it was a different thing. You know, you've got Colorado and you've got California. It's just, they're just more open to it and they use it for all sorts.
All sorts of different animal.
All sorts of different animal problems and also for fun. But many different ailments, and they're very open to it, and it's not a shock. It's not something that's taboo. So I think we could follow in that.
Move that direction, hopefully.
Yeah, why not? You know.
And this actually gets to the question for you, Hannah, from Jodie.
Mm.
It says, how long did it take for you to get over the stigma of giving cannabis your child?
I never felt stigma. What I feel is terrified of giving my child loads and loads of pharmaceuticals which have no evidence of safety. Mm-hmm. I've never felt fearful about giving him something that is natural under doctor's guidance. And actually, whether this is right or not, I've always felt that I've known what's right for my child. You know, I've lived through everything with him. Mm. He is my child. You know, as a mother, you know your child inside and out, and I know what's right for him. And I've never, ever felt that cannabis is a problem. I remember speaking to my mum at first when I decided to start using cannabis with Alfie, and I think she probably thought I was a bit mad because she was brought up in that era where, you know, you didn't, like you say, it's an illegal drug. But actually, I've been very lucky in the sense my friends, family, everyone has always just said, you know what's right for him. And so I've never felt that stigma. I'm always more fearful of giving my child benzodiazepines or steroids than cannabis.
Well, I'm sure he's living a lot longer than he would have done if he hadn't had you. So now let's move over to Susie. The Brain Fart Podcast. I don't know if that's a Twitter handle or that referring to us, but put that to one side. Question for Susie is, why is the UK so behind the US on cannabis policy? What is it about British politics culture that keeps this lasting restriction on drug policy? We have very erudite listeners, by the way.
It's a really good question. And I'm always really intrigued about how studies, when they're published, are picked up by the media in certain countries and not in others. So in the UK, we had this really strong narrative just before I started doing research in this field. But in the 90s and the early 2000s, I guess, there was this really strong narrative, cannabis causes psychosis. And it was in all the newspapers, it was kind of accepted as fact. But in the US, that media pickup of those papers when they were published just didn't happen to the same degree. So when they were talking about legalization of cannabis, there was a bit of talk about the impact of cannabis on the developing brain, about how sort of the endocannabinoid system is changing in adolescence, and therefore teenagers using cannabis might be a bad idea. But there was really very little about the link between cannabis and mental health. And I find that really interesting, that it's exactly the same research being mm-hmm. published in international journals. But mm-hmm. depending on, I guess, where the author is based or the political leanings yeah. of newspapers and that kind of thing. And in terms of sort of why it's happened in the US now and it hasn't happened here, I guess we've been distracted by lots of political nonsense going on in the last few years. And
we're talking about the US like it's... Like well, it's one
that's
country,
a really good point, actually.
And it's
yeah,
not. Because I mean, it is, but it's not
at the country level. Cannabis is still very much illegal in the yeah. US. It's state by state yeah. right. sort of yeah. legislation, but at the federal level, it's still very much illegal.
Yeah, it is,
but
yeah.
states yeah, they have their own legislation and they can
the
make their own laws.
The medicinal stores where you get your medicine, they have vaults with piles of money in it because they can't use the bank.
That's right. Yes.
Because of the federal law. So, I mean, how ridiculous is that? But it happens. They get robbed a lot.
Do they, yeah.
It's actually quite dangerous to have that much cash. That's why you'll see big security guards stood outside, because they will be robbed. So, you know, they're dealing with their own thing.
That's no, you're state completely, by state, completely you know. Right. That you can cross a state border and go from it being completely legal yep. to it being only legal for medicinal use to it being very, very much not illegal, risk prison sentence yeah, for yeah, possession. Yeah. So it's really...
You need to know, exactly. You need to know what the laws
in and
each
where the
state.
Borders are.
You've got to know where you're, where you're standing. Are.
That can be challenging, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually think part of the problem is the British media, particularly the newspapers.
Oh, yeah.
I think they've attacked drugs, you know, recreational drugs, nitrous oxide, cannabis, in a ridiculous way. And I never really understood what it was about their editors, but they've clearly got real hang-ups about these things.
Do you think it's getting better?
I think the fact we're getting medical cannabis now is making people realise you can't just say cannabis is bad. You have to have yeah. a more nuance.
I feel like there are nuance is starting. I don't know whether yeah. it's just because I've become more informed, but it does feel to me like... In terms of the media, we are getting
slowly.
More nuanced
change.
We did lose an editor for one of the worst papers recently, which was great. Onward. This is absolutely a question for you, Joss.
Oh yeah.
What is the correct dosage in a suppository for a dog with cancer? There you go.
Ah, well, it depends how big your dog is.
Yeah, quite.
and also in a suppository. Now that's something interesting. So. There was a lady I saw, this Australian lady, she had lung cancer and she had stage 4. They told her to go home and die, basically say goodbye to your family. I'm so sorry, this has not worked out with all your chemo. And her daughter said, Mum, let's try this. Let's mm-hmm. do this mm-hmm. cannabis thing. And she was like, oh my God, I can't do that. So this is where I first heard about the suppository.
Yeah.
So she had never touched cannabis in her life, didn't want anything to do with it. She changed her diet, which is very important. Also for your dog, that's very important. Just to be healthy, basically, you have to change your body from acid to alkaline, I think, mostly. That's what they say, but that's part of it. She decided that she didn't want to be high, and it was kind of upsetting her soul a little bit because some people don't enjoy it.
Yeah.
In fact,
absolutely.
Quite a lot of people don't enjoy it.
Yeah.
And she learned that if she used it as a suppository, she was good.
Yeah,
it didn't upset
good.
Her soul.
Yeah, yeah.
She just had that before she went to bed. She didn't have to deal with that. And guess what? Now she's still alive. She no longer has cancer.
No.
She mixed it with coconut oil and put it in the suppository. So if you want to know the dosing, we are making this up. Guess what? The reason why we're making this up is because there hasn't been enough studies. And also we're dealing with different bodies, different weights, different people, different dogs, different cats, whatever it is. So I went to cureyourowncancer.org,
okay.
which is amazing. That actually taught me how to make the oil. If you happen to be in a country where it is illegal and you can't get it on prescription you have to make it yourself. And when you make it yourself, you don't know what's in it. But don't blow yourself up. Don't make it over an open flame, because that is dangerous. And start slow. So even with the dog, even with Dusty, I had three tinctures. Uh-huh. There was sativa, indica, hybrid. And then once she got used to those, which I did slowly, 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 because I didn't want to upset her.
Yeah.
It's horrible to be too stone. Nobody wants
that. I think that's good advice for humans as well as dogs. Yeah. Go slow. Yeah.
And then you do the thick black oil, and then you just cross your fingers and hope.
Now, this one, getting back to you, Hannah, I mean, we don't have data on this, but drug science is trying to think about how we could collect this kind of data. Mm. It's clear that your intervention for your son has saved the health service a lot of money.
Yes.
A lot of money. Yes. Because every time he was going into intensive care, it was costing thousands of pounds a night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What do you think about the argument that actually medical cannabis would be a great saviour of the NHS?
I think that's absolutely true. It was actually part of our persuasion of the Home Office that this was a good idea, is that my mum's actually an accountant before she was retired. And so we did a very sort of layman's term spreadsheet of what cannabis was costing and what it would cost in bed days, nurses, products, all that sort of stuff in a spreadsheet. And we worked out that with the help of his paediatric consultant at our local hospital, we worked out it was costing about £200,000 a year to have Alfie in hospital. And now we pay about £35,000 a year. So it's a massive saving. And if you think that that could be times by 25,000 children with refractory epilepsy and all the people with pain and bowel problems and all that, I mean, we could save the NHS millions, absolutely millions. But the problem is I think the NHS, and as you said, this alluded to this before about training of doctors. Doctors are trained from the beginning how to prescribe pharmaceutical medications. Pharmaceutical companies are very ingrained within the NHS. Yeah, and yeah. There definitely is a financial saving, but I think it's the complete ethos of how we think about our bodies and health and well-being and that we're turning away from pharmaceuticals. And actually, people used to think, I think, that they could eat what they like, drink what they like, smoke what they like, and go to the doctor and get a tablet. So. And now we're realising that actually we need to take care of our bodies. And I think that's where cannabis comes into that well-being, holistic view of health.
My friend that was in hospital with cancer that I spoke about earlier, his diet when he was in there was like white bread and ham.
Awful. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
They're trying to cure him of something.
Well,
like
my friend's son had cancer, difficult. And she said on the cancer ward, I mean, she treated her son with cannabis oil, and because he had to have a bone marrow transplant, which wouldn't take, and then it took. And she said they did the same thing. They wheeled a trolley of chocolate round every day in the cancer ward. And you just think, well, we know glucose actually feeds cancer.
It makes no sense whatsoever.
No. Well, unfortunately, yes. There are a lot of things like that in the NHS and in politics. Yeah.
But we do love the NHS.
We do.
Yeah, yes, let's not give up on it.
No, let's never, ever, ever.
Drug science is going to... so important. Well, we have already produced, which we'll release in October when the new term starts, we've produced a teaching module, beautiful set of slides for undergraduate doctors, nurses, pharmacists. So no one will ever need to say again they don't know what medical cannabis is and how it works and what the endocannabinoids is. So we're going to put the education into
very good. Yeah,
thank God.
So we've got a couple of minutes left. Let me just, there's one important issue which we haven't touched on really, is this, I think you did a little bit, Susie, this ratio of THC to CBD, but you were talking about that in the context of the street use. But we need to talk about it a little bit in terms of the medical use, because we know that some conditions do better on high CBD and low THC, and others do better on high THC and low CBD, and someone a bit of both. And do either of you want to comment on how you decided that for your dog or your child?
I just went straight high THC.
You went straight?
Yeah, only because of what cancer. I'd learned online, yeah. the cancer
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I mean, with Alfie, we started on a full extract CBD, which has some THC in, and then we just added in a little bit of THC. I mean, it's not rocket science in that sense. You start low, you go slow, you always start with CBD, get to a good dose of high CBD, and then maybe add in a bit of extra THC with epilepsy. And this is one thing that I get very frustrated about, is the obsession in the media and with clinicians of THC. Actually, when you're talking about treating a child with epilepsy, it's a tiny, tiny part. Full extract CBD, good quality CBD is the treatment. And we know from the WHO that CBD is non-toxic, non-addictive.
Absolutely.
absolutely safe to use. But obviously with pain and stuff, you're having to look at THC and things like that. But I think the rule of thumb is to start low, go slow, see how you feel. It's difficult with children with epilepsy, usually very severe epilepsy. They're non-verbal, cognition is a problem. But I think with adults with pain, you can go on how you feel. But the most important thing is to not change your dose more than once a week, really. It took 5 weeks to show any results in Alfie at all. Mm-hmm. And I think people panic. When you're using cannabis, you've got to be very calm and you have to, you know, change doses or change whatever you're doing once a week so you can really see whether there's a benefit or not.
And you really, really need a regulated product to be able to do
Absolutely.
That as well, because
yeah.
there's been lots of studies looking at the CBD that you can buy on the high street, and the amount that they say is in it is often, very often, completely wrong, either way higher or way lower yeah. or none at all, with THC where there's not meant to be or where there isn't, where there is meant to be.
And that's the point as well, with the government changing the law and clinicians not prescribing. What are families going to do? They're going to go to unregulated sources and use, or they're going to make it.
Totally.
They're going to go to the man down the road who says, I've got plants. I mean, I have that all the time. Families contact me and say, oh, I've been offered oil from some guy who makes it around the corner.
Yeah.
Well, what's in it? How do you know? And we've seen some adults who've been given oil, and I know a guy was telling me the other day they tested it and they had morphine in it, you know, because they're putting opioids in cannabis oil. If we don't allow people to access medical cannabis for their problems, they will access it anyway. They'll go to private problem, or they'll go abroad and criminalise themselves, or they'll go to dealers and or unregulated sources.
And they'll try it out, and potentially it won't work, not because it won't work, but because
and
it's
they'll
a tiny
cannabis
dose.
Doesn't work for my child, and it's not that. It's because they probably need six bottles for actually to get any good dose of CBD.
Mm.
Well, the good news is that I am sure that this podcast will make the Department of Health think much more sensibly about what it's doing.
Let's hope so.
And we're going to, Drug Science is going to continue to lobby, pursue and facilitate the development of medical cannabis. So follow us on Twitter. We've got this very exciting new project called 2021 coming out, where we're hoping to get 20,000 people who would benefit from medical cannabis into treatment by 2021, working with the patient alliances. So watch this space. Thank you for listening. I'm just going to, before I finish, I just need to give this opportunity to each of the speakers to say one last word. So, Hannah?
Pretty much reiterating what you're saying, I will not rest until I feel that people who are very vulnerable have help in this country. We are a modern, growing country. I mean, we are a country, the seventh richest country in the world. We should be making products available to patients who need it. I feel very sad that that's not happening. And so, you know, my work is very much advocating for people who have no voice. I feel very, very strongly about that. And I think if we all do that, then there will be change. The government has to listen eventually, and the clinicians will have to listen, and we need to ask them to change their thinking about what is evidence. And I think that's really, really important.
Joss, what would you say? What would your last words be?
I have to say, this has made my day to sit here with all of you guys. It is so inspiring and encouraging. About 10 years ago, I was sat in LA at a talk about just this, and it was at the beginning of all this madness. And that, yes, there was a room full of hippies, half of them were hippies and the others were scientists. And I remember coming home to England and talking about it. And the conversation was not, it just wasn't okay. Do not discuss this. And now here we are, not only are we discussing it, but we're going to show everyone. Mm. And nobody's scared. No one around this table is scared. Everyone is good. And it's super positive. I think it's lovely. I've seen the work that cannabis can do, and I think it's very encouraging, very inspiring. So I can't wait to see what's next.
Susie?
It's really great that this conversation is moving beyond fear of an illegal substance, fear of an illicit drug, to actually acknowledging that drugs, as we think about them, are complex and can have positives and negatives. They can have risks, but they can also have potential benefits. And this kind of fear from a lack of education or misinformation being spread is beginning to be countered slowly, maybe less slowly. Maybe things are getting better all the time. And I think that's really exciting. And I think it's great that there's four quite different people all sitting around this table, all coming from very different places, but going in the same direction. And I think that's really, really positive.
Well, that's a great note on which to end. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and listen out for the next one, which will be on addiction. Thank you very much. Let's talk quickly about our live show on psychedelics, which is taking place on the 13th of November. The event will be held in central London. Space is limited and tickets are going quickly. So please go to the drugscience.org.uk website to make sure you get a space. And thank you also to today's guests, Hannah Deakin, Joss Stone and Susie Gage. Check out the show notes for details of how to follow them. And for more information on drug science, follow us on Twitter at Drug Science or go to our website, drugscience.org.uk. That's everything from us today. Join us next time for a fascinating chat about addiction. And if you like this episode, please click the subscribe button and leave us a review. Thank you for listening.